Welcome to the Institutional History Podcast, The Mad, Bad and Bizarre, a review of Woking Invalid Convict Prison, Part 2.
Your hosts for the day are Daniel Shepherd and Gemma Minter.
Crime is as much a problem today as ever. But in the latter half of the 19th century, the large-scale increase in urban populations led to public outcry, and a fear that the newly migrated rural populace would bring with them theft, assault, and murder. Looking at these next convicts, you'll see that their concerns may have been well-founded. When we think of Victorian crime, there is an image that comes to mind. Almost everyone has seen Oliver Twist, a charming tale about a band of children who have got to pick a pocket or two for their daily bread. Whilst the privations in reality were the same, the nature of the large-scale pickpocketing industry was very, very different.
One of the most commonly reported crimes is theft from the person, also known as pickpocketing. William Fisher, prisoner number 96, was one such convict, and far from working in silo, was reported as being a member of the Swell Mob.
The Swell Mob was a group of very specialised criminals who worked on the understanding that stealing from the poor would only give you so much. Their targets, therefore, were the wealthy, and they were good at working these high flyers. Looking at the history of the Swell Mob, it is clear that whilst they may have existed as a formal unit back in the 1820s and 30s, by the 1850s and the time of William's conviction, the term Swell Mob was appended to any well-dressed thieving youth.
The mob were voracious. They attended church fetes, markets, prize fights, theatres and racecourses. There are many accounts of these spectres of pecuniary deception.
The Dundee Courier, in 1850, wrote this about the group of well-dressed hoodlums. Their travelling expenses are large, for their harvests are great public occasions. There are reports of a four-day binge at Liverpool Cattle Show that allowed the mob to return in first-class carriages, and when they were caught at Euston Station, offered the police a bribe of £50, which is over £4,000 in today's money. William Fisher was very much in line with this modus operandi, being well-dressed and well-spoken, and was caught with his co-conspirator Henry Clark. The crime he was convicted of was comparatively small, divesting half a crown from Mrs. Jane Jordan, or the equivalent of £10 in today's money. He was caught less than a street away from the scene of the crime, and for that robbery, our fair-faced 19-year-old was confined to the penal system for 4 years. Fisher remained in Woking Prison for 5 months before being transferred on the Chatham, a prison hulk, to serve his remaining sentence.
In late 1859, Fisher was joined by many other thieves, cutthroats and generally disreputable members of the criminal class. For most of these men, the crime was simple, but unfortunately, the punishment proved to be just as swift.
The Protestant proletariat, Thomas Needham, prisoner 106.
Thomas was convicted in 1856 for placing gunpowder in a building with the intent to destroy it. And like his Catholic forerunner, Guy Fawkes, he appears to have done so at the request of a mysterious other.
On the 4th of January 1856, George Ward, the co-owner of a spindle manufactory, was roused from his slumber and called to his offices to discover that half a room and part of the chimney had exploded. Mr. Ward examined the room thoroughly, and eventually found a section of a watering can dangling from a rope in what was left of the chimney. Ward, realising this was clearly the start of the detonation, sent for the constabulary. There was little evidence. The owners of the business had received no threat. In fact, had the following events not transpired, it's likely that, in an age before forensics, Mr. Needham may have walked away scot-free.
A few days after the event, Ward received a poorly spelt letter.
Mr. Ward, get shut of Etchells and Spooner or you'll rue the day. I know where you live in the daytime. I can find it in the night and I shall do. If you don't quit Etchells and Spooner, I shall storm Sebastopol. You can watch until your eyes come out. You will never catch us. We are invisible.
The letter, signed Old Nicholas, didn't make much sense, and the author's identity at this point was still shrouded in mystery.
And then, on the 31st of January, a letter was given to the police. It detailed information, later recanted, that Thomas Needham had plotted with his brother-in-law, Henry Bradley, to blow up the factory.
The pair were arrested, and Needham, showing a serious lack of intelligence, believed the officer would pay him the sum of £50 for a true confession. Immediately he confirmed that he had been the planter of the bomb, on the request of a shadowy someone unknown. This shadowy collaborator promised to pay Needham enough money to help him start a new life in America with his mistress. He stated that he wrote the letters, and his innocent brother-in-law was only implicated because of a personal argument about Needham's unsavoury relationship with his mistress, Mrs. Chapman. Thomas was sentenced to 4 years' imprisonment, leaving his wife, and their 4 children, to fend for themselves. Unusually, Needham served his full sentence, and did not enjoy a day of leave on license for public works, presumably having been too unsafe.
Lovers and mistresses are a frequent motive for our criminal class, and our next criminal takes this somewhat to the extreme.
The romantic sailor, George Lamb, prisoner 114. On the 11th of August, 1845, George Lamb was married to Bridget MacDonald in St. John's Church. They were very much in love, and reports say that the next 3 years of their lives were happy by anyone's standards. Lamb lived up to his family's historical felicity in marriage, and the pair were envied for their love. According to family friends, they bore a child, and were together, content, until, as happens to those in Lamb's profession, the sea beckoned.
Lamb sailed on the ship Empire, plying his trade as a sailor does, and appears to have been struck by the beauty of one of the passengers, Miss Margaret Fee. He courted her, and on the 19th of August 1848, 3 years and 6 days after he married Bridget, he married Margaret, in New York at a Roman Catholic church. Their union appears to have been equally felicitous, and continued together until December of 1854.
Lamb, during this period, would still be roaming the high seas, even as his eyes and hands roamed further afield.
Word reached Margaret that her husband of 6 years had been previously married in England, and so she came to England, presumably to find out if the rumours were true.
Jane Harris, a beautiful 22-year-old barmaid, had first met Lamb in the summer of 1855, and by February had quit her position and married the now trigamist. They appeared content, despite or because of his frequent absences. In January 1856, Lamb returned from a 3-month stint in Boston, and on his return to his youngest wife was promptly arrested.
The court case that followed was highly publicised, and public indignation reached fever pitch over how 3 such fine and hard-working women could be so easily duped.
The defendant claimed, through his representatives, that his last wife married him whilst he was drunk, a charge she denied. He was convicted on the 5th of March 1856 of the crime of bigamy, and sentenced to 4 years of penal servitude, the full balance of which he paid. As a side note, his recorded next of kin was his first wife, Bridget Lamb. We can't be sure if this was his preference, that of legality, or quite simply because none of his other wives would own him after such an embarrassing and public debacle. In a world without background checks, tracking, CCTV and other security measures, trust was the only currency which one could rely on. A working-class man who sounded middle-class would probably have been thought of as just down on his luck, but no doubt a trustworthy fellow on account of his previous standing. Whereas a rough or unseemly-looking gent could be considered a member of the criminal class, irrespective of his intentions or goodness. These easy-to-blur lines can cause serious confusion for all involved. One pawnbroker, Mr. England, was soundly berated by a judge presiding over our next convict's trial, for falling for the erudite behaviour of Mr. Robert Marsh, prisoner number 134. Marsh was a militiaman, a soldier charged with protecting the country, but in the end only protected himself. He was indicted for larceny, and not simply the theft of property belonging to a person, no, but the property of the church. This was a sacrilegious act that received significant censure. Marsh, who was 18 at the time, with his 20-year-old friend Jonathan Reed, stole communion cups to the value of £12, £962 in today's money, from the house of a trustee of the church, a Mr. Timothy Edward Bean. After absconding with their booty, they attempted to sell the property, but the first broker, not easily deceived, declined to buy, being under the impression that this was not acquired legally. Mr. England, the second broker, on the other hand, was easier to persuade. The mired pair, Marsh and Reed, hit upon damaging the cups so that they would be unrecognisable, and thus make their task easier by selling them as scrap. England bought, and, when questioned, said he was incredibly sorry for being fooled, but that he was thrown off guard by the apparent respectability and manners of the young man. The judge was less than impressed. Marsh was imprisoned for 4 years, as it was not his first offence, and his companion Reed, as a first-time convict, served just 1 year of hard labour. Most of Marsh's sentence was spent in the normal prison system, but at the tail end of his service he was transferred to Woking with our previously mentioned inmates.
So on to our last convict of this podcast, William Smith, prisoner 192. Whilst his crime was a common one, his imprisonment is still interesting.
On the 23rd of September 1856, William was convicted of theft aggravated by habit and repute. He was a common hawker and was transferred to Woking Prison after stints in Wakefield and Portland to complete his sentence. He was assigned to the association cell. An association cell is formed to hold multiple prisoners and was very different to the separation in vogue in the 1850s across the country, which were aimed at giving convicts ample time to think about their past mistakes and hopefully encourage them to repent. William and his association cell are a rare record in Woking Prison, as he is the first prisoner to be listed as being in one. Curiously, no other prisoners are listed in being in this cell.
He arrived in September 1860 and was immediately inducted into the world of Woking prison life. Summer days started early, 5:15, and in winter only half an hour later than that. Personal hygiene and cleaning of the cells took the first half hour of any day, followed by breakfast, which was the longest mealtime allotted. It would last an hour and 5 minutes. That included serving, sitting, eating, returning to cells, and then the real work began. At 7:15 in summer and 7:45 in winter, the working day commenced.
Whilst Woking was aimed at the disabled, that absolutely did not mean that these prisoners got away with not working. In summer, they worked for 9.5 hours. This was astutely reduced to 7.5 in winter to take into consideration the lack of light and, even more astutely, to reduce the cost of heating extra rooms late into the day.
The infirm men knitted. They picked oakum, a tarred rope used for caulking boats. They bound books and picked coir, a tough fibre that was used for matting and mattresses throughout the prison systems. The more able-bodied laid bricks, engaged in carpentry, swept chimneys, cleaned the building, and cared for the bedbound. No one who could be put to work managed to avoid being put to work. The punishment for malingering was significant, and we'll go into that in a future episode.
The regime sounded punishing, but it worked on Mr. Smith. He was under the supervision of the Woking wardens for 8 months before he was released back into society, apparently a reformed figure. Woking was beginning to get results. Tune into next month's podcast to find out more twists and tales in the lives of Woking's inmates. Thank you for listening to the Institutional History's second podcast. We couldn't have got this far without the London Archives, the British Library, and the Woking Lightbox. Special thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the use of his music in our podcast. Any comments, requests, or feedback, please send this through to our email, institutionalhistory@gmail.com. To find out more, sign up to our monthly newsletter on our website, institutionalhistory.com.